Welcome back to Raising Rare. We are in our fifth season talking about the joys, challenges, and surprises of raising children with a rare disease. Our co-hosts, Sanath Ramesh and Brittany Ratke, will keep you updated on their kiddos. And we hope our lineup of guests will give you new insights and hope. My name is Kevin Fryert. Welcome back to Raising Rare. You know, we've had a few episodes where we talked about having a strong care team, how having a team that knows the kiddo can make all the difference. One of the key parts of those care teams are the nurses. And today we're talking to a very experienced nurse, Neil Eade, who has a particular interest in helping families with the transitions they need to make during their journeys. But first, how's Raghav doing, Sanath?
He's just recovering from a sickness, but I think he's made it out. So I'm excited and looking forward to the next few days.
So Neil, I think you're the first guest that we've interviewed that's been a nursing professional. We have many parents and who happen to be nurses, but this is the first person who's going to be talking just as a professional and what they've seen. So can you tell us a little bit about your career history?
Okay, I graduated from nursing school in 1980, and since that time, I've been working in pediatrics. I've been a pediatric nurse for 40 years, 30 years of which I practiced as an advanced practice nurse, both a clinical nurse specialist and a nurse practitioner, particularly over the last 25 years. I've always had a primary focus in chronic illness. I was a faculty member at my alma mater, and I taught in the advanced practice program that had a chronic illness concentration. So I've always kind of taken an interest in the chronically ill child and the challenges they face. So I've worked in every area in pediatrics primarily. I've worked in critical care, ward care, outpatient. I worked in a variety of settings, all in pediatrics.
And how'd you get into nursing and that pediatric focus?
Well, kind of circuitously. I got out of the military and was very interested in adult education, and I took some courses in undergraduate, and then I switched to early childhood education. And for a period of time, I also toyed with the idea of being a psych major. So I kind of was trying to find myself while I was in undergraduate. And I thought that being a psych nurse would probably be a quicker way to a career. Nursing was at the time, it was not a bad profession, and I could still do psych like I was interested in. But then when I trained in my undergraduate program, I fell in love with pediatrics. And so that is how I ended up in nursing. It wasn't my intention initially to do nursing, and then I fell in love with nursing and pediatrics.
Well, falling in love with pediatrics, my wife and I have talked a lot about eventually going and working at a NICU. Because you have all these cute little babies, you know, that need help, but then they're really cute and you can't help but really fall in love with them.
I spent a lot of time in doing NICU as well. A lot of the crossover between the pediatric intensive care unit and the neonatal intensive care unit early in my career. So yeah, I really tended to find the best time caring for young children. Infants, toddlers.
Are the parents rough on nurses in the NICU or on the PICU? Because I know parents are always anxious when they get into one of these ICUs.
I think when you're talking ICU care in general, parents are under a lot of stress with a sick child. They're oftentimes not at their best. And I think as a nurse, being on a front line, you know, we don't have little snapshots of patients coming in for rounds and then leaving. We're there at the bedside all day long. And so it's incumbent on us to establish that relationship and establish that therapeutic relationship with a family. So it's really kind of a no-brainer for a nurse to understand that a parent is going through probably one of the most difficult times in their lives. It's crucial that we understand that and respond to that. But I don't think it's any worse in the NICU than it is in the PICU. You're dealing with a new parent who hasn't bonded with their child, and then you're dealing with a parent where the child may be 6 or 7 years old, and they've spent 6 years of their lives caring for this child. So there may be a heightened sense of concern of parents with an older child than a new parent. So I would say that would be the only factor that might influence the process.
Well, and I think about Sana's question slightly differently, knowing Sana's situation, Brittany's situation. They've spent a lot of times in those ICUs, so they come in knowing something now. And I wondered if that's what you meant is, you know, once the parents know a little more, it's a little tougher to manage them.
Well, that's true. And I remember talking to you earlier when I was preparing for this podcast, because when I was in nurses training, we had this required reading called From Novice to Expert. And it talked about nursing expertise that wasn't necessarily a function of time and experience as a nurse, but really the development of clinical wisdom over time that really made the difference in terms of where you transition from being a novice to being an advanced beginner. I think early in my career, after I read that, I thought about parents maybe being within the same paradigm. They're novice to expert. So what happens when you get an expert parent with a novice nurse? The novice nurse is everything by the book. Got to do it this way. This is how I was taught to do it. There's no other way. And the parent, who is an expert, may be having cared for their child for 6 years, have explored other options for doing the same thing and say, well, this is what works for me. And I think it's important that nursing understands that. And the other same problem occurs when there's an expert nurse in the room and a novice parent, because the novice has just learned how to do a certain thing and they are by the book and they see you deviate from that and they go into panic mode. So, you know, I think it's kind of a good way of looking at a transactional analysis approach to your interrelationships with a family. It's like, okay, I'm an expert nurse. I walk into the room and I have an expert parent and I'm doing something, a procedure or what have you. How do you do this? What works well for you? And exploring the options that the parent have found to be successful in the care of their child. Having that respect for the parent as an expert, and for the novice nurse to learn how to respect parents that may know a little bit more than they do about a given situation or their child's condition.
It's you put it so eloquently, because I always think about this when we get into the ICU, and when the shift change happens and the nurse walks in, my mind is constantly looking for signals that tell me if they are an expert or a novice nurse. And usually, in the first three lines of a conversation, I can figure that out. If they are by the books or not. And if they look at my child and say something that's exactly by the books, then I know they are a novice nurse. And through the day, I will have more patience and sometimes more direction and guidance for them. And for things like putting on a G-tube or how to connect them, and they bring a pump and that sort of like talk as if I don't know how to do that, then I know they're a novice nurse. Then I would just tell them, hey, don't worry about it. I got it. I can handle all of these. Don't stress over these little things. Right.
So before I mentioned that you're going to talk to us about transitions, can you tell us a little bit more about the work you've done around pediatric to adult transition? For patients, but also for the parents. Why is that important to you?
Well, early on in my career, working with chronically ill children, this has reared its head on many times in my career where parents struggle with this and caregivers struggle with this. And there wasn't a lot of knowledge when I first became an advanced practice nurse. There wasn't a lot of knowledge about transitioning kids from most of the information we had about transitions that were done successfully back in the 80s were with the hemophilia populations, with where you had caregivers that in adult world that were learning how to care for those kids, or the cystic fibrosis patient where life expectancy was so much shorter than it is today, where you didn't worry about those transitions. And as children became older with those conditions, it became more and more clear to me that there needs to be some process in place, that I saw too many situations where it was an event rather than a process, where, okay, the child's 18, they show up in triage in the emergency room, they've been cared for that in the hospital for 18 years of their life, and suddenly they're shifted over to the adult emergency department where no one knows them, and they're admitted to an adult unit where none of the patients, none of the caregivers know them. The parents don't know the caregivers. They have no relationship with them. And it becomes a very, very, I've seen it happen all too often, and disastrous outcomes. So I started looking and exploring at that process a little bit more. And as I started developing my career as an educator, I started researching most of the literature on that topic. I started becoming, I started speaking on the topic on various conferences. One of them, I was at the Society for Pediatric Nurse Practitioners, where I teamed up with a nurse practitioner that worked in transplant. We shared that conversation. And I brought in a discussion points about the intestinal failure patients that I was working with, what formerly called short bowel syndrome, where those patients were getting older and aging out of their pediatric caregivers. And so, I had a good friend, a colleague, who had taken their doctorate work at NYU, and they were ortho rehab and specialized in the spina bifida population. And she found in her research that it took over 2 years to successfully transition one of her kids to adult caregivers. They have orthopedic surgeons, they have general surgeons, they have urologic surgeons, they have neurologists, they have an abundance of caregivers that are all brought to bear on that care. And to find caregivers and to successfully transition all those caregivers is a challenge and takes time. That, again, with the notion that this is a process and not an event, you cannot just do that as an event on their 18th birthday.
It's fascinating. I never thought of the transition as being a challenge. And as you explain how the process was mismanaged in a situation, I can start to imagine how much I rely on the current set of nurses and the doctors that know my child in and out, for them to take care of him when he's in the hospital. When we go to the hospital, we know we are going to see the same set of nurses or the doctors. We know they understand him very well, not just looking at the notes, but talking to other care professionals. Now, last year, my son got admitted multiple times in the hospital, and we would end up at least one day during the visit having the same nurse that knows him. It's fascinating, and it makes a huge difference for us because we know that this person knows him and we can step back and take a breather. But then if everything changes on the 18th birthday, oh, that's cruel. And I don't want, like, another big factor that I just love about the children's hospital is that when kids go there, everyone treats them as a children, right? As a child, as a kid. And that's how I treat my child. That's how everyone treats them, right? He's cute, he's small, he's nice. And they talk in funny voices. They bring, you know, there's music therapy that brings in guitar and plays nursery rhymes that he likes. It's all nice and cozy. And I don't want on his 80th birthday to be treated like a 60-year-old man, an adult, right? That has emotions, that has sophisticated egos, right? My child wouldn't have any of that. He's just going to be a tiny little kid with probably the developmental age of a two-year-old.
Yes, and I think that hospitals, it's incumbent on hospitals to take and see this as a priority, particularly hospitals within a hospital. I worked in hospitals within a hospital almost my entire, only worked for a freestanding children's hospital for 3 years of my career. It's a lot easier to do it there, but some hospitals have developed young adult units, and they just transition those patients to those adult units that are mostly young adults with chronic conditions. And you're even seeing clinics now cropping up that are focusing on Lifespan has a clinic, a transition clinic. I'm not as familiar with that because it's fairly new, but the role of that clinic is to coordinate that and work with primary providers and other caregivers to kind of make that transition successful. I think it's really important that, that it's a multifaceted approach that needs to happen when you're doing these transitions. And it's extremely disconcerting for a parent to have this as an event. And that's why I always say that you need to start preparing that very young, that transition, to start working on just little things.
You may be one of our listeners who is actively trying to find treatments for your rare kiddo, because no one else is. Have you ever felt like just when you thought you understood how to find and develop treatments, there's something new to learn? One more step. Imagine a place you can go to see the big picture and drill down to the details you need today. We at Salem Oaks are building that place. We are calling it the Biopharmaceutical Atlas for Discovery and Development, your self-paced guide to understanding the process of medical research and development. We call it the Atlas for short. Each month, we will deliver at least 30 minutes of bite-sized microlearning content that you can digest when it is convenient for you. We need your help to design the Atlas to meet your needs. So check us out at www.salemoaks.com/atlas.
That helped to make that transition smoother, more seamless.
You mentioned young adult units. I think that sounds like an amazing transitionary step. But for a hospital to develop a children's unit, I understand the need for it, right? In a hospital to develop an adult unit, I understand the need for it. Besides the patient need, which is obvious and we've talked about it, like what incentives do the hospital have to create a young adults unit?
I think the incentive is pretty clear. It's that patient satisfaction. We always talk about patient satisfaction and patient-centered care, rather than system-centered care or hospital-centered care, where the decisions are made based on the providers and what's convenient or best for them sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. And I think hospitals need to take their talking points into reality if we're really concerned about patient-centered care, family-centered care. Really need to start considering these options. And I think that hospitals are starting to do that, because over the past 20 years, I think the whole knowledge base for the transition process has exploded. And hopefully, we're going to see improvements.
When you mean knowledge base, are you talking about like books or literature papers? Like, is this more of a advocacy concept, or is this now starting to get into the mainstream? You know, there's training, there's a paper in JAMA on like, you know, young adult care and transitions, and like talking about it in a more formal setting.
It's absolutely present in every journal dealing with children. The American Academy of Pediatrics has position statements on that, and it's based on the best literature. There are clinics that are run by family nurse practitioners who do adult and pediatric that focus on these transitions. If you go to annual meetings for professional meetings, I'm going to one this Friday or tomorrow, actually, the American Society for Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition. And they have had transitions on their presentations on transitions every year for the past few years. Some of the caregivers have actually published and participate in conferences. Are you familiar with the Oley Foundation?
I am.
Oley Foundation is a group of consumers, and they have adult and children with chronic conditions, and they have an annual meeting as well. And I have seen focus groups that are geared toward caregivers that were presented by professionals who work in the field. So you're seeing literally an explosion of this topic, both in formal education of clinicians and with formal education of parents and caregivers.
It is. It's incredible. I knew you were going to say incredible there, Sana, because when you see the nurse come in and they're making the funny voices and they're making you feel comfortable, and they just seem so human, right? And you don't realize there's this professional background and development and everything behind them that's just as serious as all the people who come in and don't have that caring demeanor. So I want to know, what are the barriers for people like Sanath and Brittany to a successful transition when their child is moving toward that 18th birthday, but may still be, you know, a decade away from that? What are the barriers?
Well, I think both for parents and caregivers alike, I've seen situations where caregivers had the established relationship and a bond with a family and a child that they're unwilling or reticent to give up. And so that can be a barrier if they don't want to let go. The parent, obviously, we've already touched on that. They're used to caregivers. They're used to a certain environment for their child, and to have to give that up is very disconcerting. So that's the first and foremost barrier. And I think one of the ways that you can combat that is in doing the transition. The pediatric caregivers can't just turn it off like a faucet. It has to be a process as well, which means they have to stay involved, and sometimes for a couple of years during that transition, to keep in communication with the parents, the family, the child, and to keep in communication with those adult caregivers that they're making that transition. The pediatric urologist stay involved long enough for the adult urologist to get a relationship going with that family. That's one way to strengthen those barriers. The other barrier is the lack of resources, lack of caregivers that are committed, that have the knowledge to make these transitions and to help families work through them, because it's something that needs to be started with a child at an early age. You can't just wait until they're 17 and say, oh, we're going to have to transition him in a year. And some pediatric providers will hang on to kids until they're 21, 22. But that doesn't mean that the transition process should wait.
In one of the previous episodes, we talked about the doctors and the nurses of a particular patient visiting them on their wedding day. And it was just like, and the scientists, right? And it was just incredibly moving to see their commitment towards a person, right? Not a patient towards a person. That's a big difference, because a patient tends to, you know, generate the connotation of this person in a healthcare system, right? The person is just a human, another human. Have you or the people you know been in this community, have been a part of any of these special events like this? What does the community think about sort of continuing that relationship with the person even after the transition has happened?
I think it's reasonable. I think that it's fine for, I know physicians and nurses alike who are still in contact with patients that they've cared for 15, 20 years ago. I still get emails from parents whose kids are older, even after I've been retired. So I know that, you know, but you have to be careful. And particularly pediatric nurses, there's this phenomenon called the adoption process that's seen with pediatric caregivers, to where rather than empower families to advocate for their child in a process, they take the role of advocate so seriously that they are almost usurping the role of the parent in the process. There is a therapeutic relationship that needs to occur, and the expert nurse knows that there are certain boundaries in that relationship. Yes, you have a very strong bond with a patient, particularly nurses who go into the home for care. That changes everything. And we have nurses who will sometimes, the boundaries that get a little blurry. And you see this in pediatric psych nurses even more, that they feel that a child has gone through such horrific experiences that they feel the need to almost adopt them and become like a surrogate parent. And that can sometimes undermine a parent's ability to advocate for their child. So that's one of the things that I have worked on with other nurses as well, in terms of establishing supports for nurses. Like, you don't have to go out and buy all these birthday gifts for a patient that you've bonded with while in the hospital, where a child is in the next room and sees all these gifts being lavished onto this child on their birthday, and they say, why am I not special like that? It's okay to maybe go over some boundaries, but you always need to. You can't have a strict right or wrong. You have to be able to understand why you're doing this. Am I doing this because I'm codependent with this family? That it's part of developing my own self-esteem. Or am I truly advocating for the patient? So this whole relationship and transition is fraught with emotional issues as well, that I think nurses struggle with just like parents do.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine the bond that would be built over, you know, say a 10, 12-year period of caregiving with in an in-home setting, for example. Like, we have nannies in home and they've been with us for years now, right? And I can not help but think how closely they have bonded with my son. And what would they feel if there's a loss, right? It doesn't have to be the loss of the child. It could be a loss of the job, right? It could be the family moving to a different town, and suddenly you... this person that was a part of your life for the last decade is not a part of your life anymore. And I'm assuming that would just feel just as much traumatic as losing a person. Are there mental health resources, any special resources besides the usual sort of dealing with grief and other things that are geared towards these professionals?
When I first started looking at this, I was working in a hospital where we wanted to establish a guideline for nurses in terms of developing a therapeutic relationship. It's surrounded around birthday parties, funerals, situations where nurses feel compelled to act. And we set up a series of vignettes to discuss with the nursing staff. And understandably, we got a huge amount of pushback from nurses who felt that, well, that just means I don't care about the patient. Well, yes, you're okay to care about the patient. And we're not telling you do this or don't do this. What we're telling you is to think about it. And I think hospitals have developed guidelines and educational series about doing just that. And I think where hospitals have run into problems is when they've established standards of practice, or this is what you have to do as a nurse, because it drives those behaviors underground. So it needs to be something that you work with nurses and physicians, actually, in terms of of navigating a very, very difficult process, particularly with kids with chronic conditions.
So this has been really good conversation. I want to know, Neil, you know, I think we've covered everything we thought we were going to in a slightly different pattern than we thought we were, but that's fine. I want to know, is there anything you want to leave for our listeners? What's the one takeaway message you would want to share?
I would say for parents, if we're talking about transitions to adult care, to start thinking about it early. Even if your caregiver is not thinking about it early. Like, for example, I have kids with central venous access devices, for example. And these kids can get involved as early as 5 or 6 years old. We have parents hooking up the syringe to their line for them after they've practiced their asepsis, their prevention of infection techniques, and allow the child to push the saline in to flush their line and do the same with the heparin in to lock their line. That's a very simple thing, and kids can be participants in their care. And that transitions as they get older, say, for example, helping to inventory their supplies, looking to see what supplies are low. When they get older, starting to order their supplies. So there are a variety of things that parents can do based on what they observe as their child's abilities and their developmental level to start letting them participate. And I've also seen caregivers in an office setting talk over the child, and even some parents talk over the child, and not really allow the child to participate in their care and tell the caregivers what they're feeling, what they would like. And then helping families that struggle with that as the child gets older. As you know, parents who've dealt with adolescents with no healthcare problems, they struggle with those issues where a kid is 17 years old and they're going to be 18 next year and I'm almost an adult. You can't tell me what to do. I had one parent in a transition breakout session say, well, my son turned 18 and his doctor said he wanted to start him on a new medication. And he said, I'm taking enough medications. I don't want that. And it freaked mom out. You know, I mean, she's been making decisions for this kid, you know, his whole life. And now all of a sudden, she's dealing with this young adult that wants to make decisions on their own. And being able to distinguish between what's possible for them, and sometimes that's difficult for a parent, and what's letting them go, letting them start to make decisions about their care. We talk about making negotiated risk-taking for an adolescent. An example is a patient who has dialysis. It's a negotiated risk to go out and have pizza and beer the night before your dialysis. But if you're the night after your dialysis and you're not going to see dialysis for another few days, maybe it's not okay to have pizza and beer. But do we tell that patient, no, you can't have pizza and beer ever because you're on dialysis? That's not going to make them very successful in managing their illness. So you need to be smart about choosing what decisions are negotiated and are not going to be too high a risk, and those that are low risk, that make the condition fit in their lives, because everybody has got to make this fit in their life.
Fascinating. I never thought of just so many dimensions of this transition. I thought, okay, I'm going to go from this primary care to another primary care. But oh my God, I've never thought of this. I really wish Brittany was talking to us in this conversation, because compared to my son, her daughter has a lot more capabilities where she would be in a position to start, you know, practicing a lot of the advice. For listeners, if you have heard me asking very intelligent questions today, it's because Brittany has been typing these questions out and I've been her voice. She had a technical glitch and she couldn't, she's listening in, but she's not speaking to us. Thanks, Brittany.
I'm happy to do this again with Brittany at any time, or anybody else for that matter, if they want to have these discussions. It's, as you can see, it's something I get very animated and passionate about.
And I think it's through all these conversations we have with people, we say over and over to ourselves, I learned something new from that conversation. Now we're looking at it from like a totally different perch. And you can start to see things and say, oh yeah. So, you know, as you raise a child, whether they're rare or not, what you're trying to do is get them to a point of some level of independence, right? This is what we do with all our children as we do this. And you do it a little by little by little. And the examples you gave were perfect for, oh yeah, they like to be involved. If it's just pushing the saline, if it's just saying when it happens, if it's, you know, that little bit of dignity that you give them as you do that, and then they grow into it. It just had never thought of it that way before. It's fantastic.
They got to have choices.
Well, I want to thank you, Neil. This was fascinating. I hope you have a great conference that you said you're heading off to. And I can think of several other conferences you should probably come and speak at. So I may be on the line with you afterward.
Oh, sure. Anytime. I'm happy to help.
We hope you enjoyed today's conversation on Raising Rare. Please subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast platform. We would love to get your feedback through ratings and reviews. And this week, tell someone that you think would be helped by our conversations on Raising Rare that they should be tuning in too.